Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Learning Pod Network, brought to you by Impact Connections, where we'll be taking a deep dive into the new world of learning pods that are driving educational innovation around the world. I'm your host, Steve Eno. The world has been changed forever by COVID-19. Right now, families and schools around the country are trying to figure out the best way forward without much support. That is why we have created the Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. We believe small group learning, driven by family needs and supported through a network of strong relationships, can improve education for everyone in this moment and beyond. On this podcast, we'll bring you advice from innovative educators and experts to help you create the best learning pod experience possible. If you are running your own learning pod or collection of learning pods, we would love for you to join our Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. Joining our network will give you access to all of our resources to take the teaching and learning happening in your learning pod to the next level, and will open up doors to more connections and opportunities for your students. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about the benefits and how to join. But if you would like more information now, please go to www.impactconnections.org/community. Buggy eyes, tell me what
to hear. You're looking like you're in the sky. Hi, everyone. Today we have an amazing guest, Paul Emmerich, who gives us some really important perspective about what it's like to be a teacher during these stressful times. And so Paul is a National Board Certified Educator in Chicago. His writing has been featured in a number of prominent education publications, such as EdSurge, ASCD's Educational Leadership, and the International Literacy Association's Literacy Today. He has also been featured in The New Yorker, and he just recently left his job, and we get a chance to talk about why he left and the challenges that he faced in terms of making the decision and just how teachers are being treated during COVID-19. And I think this is a reflection of how teachers have been treated for a long time. And I think it's just important to hear his perspective. And so if you could listen to the episode today and just be open to his perspective and some of the insights that he gives in terms of what it's like to be a teacher. So enjoy.
I thought we might start by just getting a little bit of your background. I've read off your biography a little bit, but I think the biography sometimes can miss some of the most important parts of our background that kind of creates us and our insights and where we've been and what we believe today. So I'd love for you to kind of walk through some of your work, whether it be about your book or some of your previous jobs. It kind of has shaped the teacher that you are today and been able to allow you to become a nationally board certified teacher.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me today. I'm really excited to be here. You know, one of my friends one time said to me, the reason you become a teacher is very different than the reason you stay a teacher. And now 10 years in, I understand that a lot more now. I became a teacher because I really enjoyed connecting with kids. I remember my first ever child-facing job was at a summer camp / daycare when I was in college. And I just really loved being around kids. It was just really fun. And I remember that was when I decided I was going to change my major in college. And I was originally music education. And then I was like, no, I'm going to go for elementary education. And I had mentioned it to a parent at the summer camp who was also a teacher. And I said, yeah, I'm switching my major. I'm going to become an elementary ed major. And she was like, don't do it. Don't do it. And I was like, whoa, that was not the, that was not the response I was expecting. Right. But this was, I don't know how many years into No Child Left Behind, probably like 8 or 9 at that point. And she just said, the pressures and everything, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, so I continued on anyway. I did it anyway. I finished my degree and I started working in public school. And, you know, it actually was a really great experience for the most part. My first district I worked for was pretty progressive and did a lot of teacher training. And so I learned a lot about like backward design and mastery learning and standards-based assessment and project-based learning. And I had a fair amount of autonomy to like sort of explore, unit design. I had this amazing team that I worked with, who I'm still close with. Like, we haven't worked together for 6 years now. And they were all at my wedding last year. Like, we still keep in touch, even though I moved and moved back. So, but I left that job because there was a lot of homophobia in that school district. And just as an openly gay man, it's, you know, you got to feel safe at work. You got to feel welcomed at work. And ultimately, what ended up happening, to make a very, very long story short, was a colleague of mine and I wanted to teach about marriage equality after it was legalized in Illinois. You know, we figured, well, it's legal now. It's like a law. So it seems like you can like teach about laws, right?
Right.
And it just didn't. Our administration was extremely upset. And it was very like that kind of gaslighty thing where it's like, well, people aren't ready for this. Wait 5 years. And, you know, a lot of like, oh, Paul, it sounds like you're taking this personally that you can't do this. And I was like, yeah, I'm taking it very personally that I can't do this.
Right.
So it really forced me to look elsewhere. And that's how I found the California job. And so I just kind of on a whim, like I had my final interview in June of 2014 and I moved in July of 2014. And all of a sudden I was living in San Francisco, which was wild.
Right.
And I was there for 3 years and our charge there was technology powered personalized learning. And at first I was super excited about it. I thought it was like the thing that was going to change all of education. And over the course of my 3 years, I just realized how unaware I was about the system and systemic constraints and really my own privilege too. I got really in touch with that and seeing that no amount of digital technology is going to change the systemic issues within education, and that actually companies that are doing things like this, it's really grounded in turning a profit and draining money from the education system as opposed to, you know, really reforming it. Because the model for the company was, it was entirely privatized, right? So there was inevitably going to be an economic barrier there for low-income kids, and then by proxy, of course, people of color as well. And it just dawned upon me, one day I reached the tipping point where I was like, oh, this actually isn't going to work, you know? And so I decided to come back to Chicago. And that's also that experience in Silicon Valley was the, you know, inspiration for my book, Reclaiming Personalized Learning. And so now I do a lot of writing and talking about what it means to make learning personal and trying to debunk that myth that, you know, personalized learning isn't necessarily giving every kid their own activity or playing into that like just grandiose sense of individualism, like everything has to be tailored to me like it is on Amazon or whatever. It doesn't have to be like that. We can actually do a lot together.
Right.
And still make it meaningful and personal, and then also create a more sustainable workload for teachers. So I've been doing that for the past couple of years now. And then recently I just left my teaching job because I've just been really disappointed by how so many schools are handling this crisis. It's just traumatizing in some ways because you think it can't get any worse as a teacher. And you would think that in the midst of like a global pandemic that is legitimately scary and life-threatening, that when people are making decisions about reopening schools, that they would listen to their teachers, because the teachers are going to be the ones that are on the front lines, right, in the most direct line of harm. And so I don't feel comfortable doing this, and I'm going to figure something else out. And luckily, I mean, I want to acknowledge my privilege here, because I have a husband that supports me. I have a husband that I can get health insurance from, you know, and I know that's not the case for a lot of people. A lot of people are saying, I'm staying because I need my insurance.
Right.
I have the flexibility. I have a little bit of a runway to just like figure this out. And I'm terrified, but I just want to acknowledge the privilege there, because I think some feedback I've gotten is like, don't glorify this. And it's like, I'm not trying to glorify this, but I am trying to shine a spotlight on the difficult decisions that so many teachers are facing right now, which is, do I go to school and put myself at risk, even though I don't trust my school to like actually handle the situation, or do I leave and just try and figure out my financial situation on my own?
Right. Yeah. And I have a lot I would love to talk about in everything that you just said in terms of your history. But I think a place that we could start is this moment, because I think so many people are not aware of the situation that a lot of teachers are put in right now. And what you just said in terms of having some flexibility, again, I'm in a similar situation where my wife is super supportive. She allowed me to leave my last teaching job because, again, she has insurance. We have some financial runway. I'm able to stay home with the kids and teach and try and create a new business around education. But most teachers do not have that option. There are countless teachers that I've talked to, both at schools that I've worked at in the past and teachers that are just people that I've gotten in touch with over the years, who basically say, hey, I would love to try something different, but I can't. I am stuck in this position. I need the benefits. I need the salary. They look at their skill set and they say, well, where else could I work? And they don't think that they have any options. And so teachers, even before COVID, I have kind of realized that teachers feel stuck. There's just so much that's put on their plate. They can't necessarily change their school or their system the way that they believe in. So they end up putting up with a ton. And so I'd love to start there and dig into that a little bit more in terms of what are teachers like dealing with right now? Before you left your job, what are all those things that have been thrown at you, either with COVID or related to COVID or even previously to COVID, that most people don't know about? And I think this is something that has been very surprising to me in terms of the huge swing in public perception of teachers. Like right when the COVID hit, everyone's like, oh, teachers are amazing. They should be paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, this is impossible. How do they do what they do? And then all of a sudden that has changed to, oh, teachers are selfish because they're not going back to work. They're putting themselves ahead of their kids and it's not that big of a risk. Like, it just blew me away that there was that big of a shift. And I think it's largely because people don't realize what teachers go through on a daily basis. And so, yeah, so I'd love to get your thoughts about what situation teachers are in right now and what they're having to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, where do I begin?
Yeah.
I mean, that whole thing in March and April really pissed me off, honestly. I was just like, are we all really that shocked that teachers are paid so little?
Right, right.
Like, come on, Reese. Like, did you see that Reese Witherspoon, like, tweet?
Yeah, right.
I think it was like, okay, like, you can't use this, like, as a... I just feel like parents and influencers online, not non-education influencers online, were like, it was like this moment of humor for them that, oh, my kids are so poorly behaved and I can't get them to do any work at home and this is so hard and ha 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 ha. And it's like, hey, actually, it's not funny.
Right.
And like, this moment shouldn't be used as a moment to get you attention on social media. This should be a moment to amplify teacher voices and raise awareness. And so I think the obvious things that teachers were going through in April, March and April and May, were the fact that we had to translate an entire curriculum into a digital curriculum, all the while having parents watch us teach all the time,
right,
which depending on where you teach, that can be really unnerving, right? Because I will say from a personal standpoint, I want to say that my experience with April and May was that my families were so supportive of me. Like, so supportive. I did not get any pushback or criticism or anything from any of my family. So I'm not saying this is a personal indictment of any of them or anything, because they were amazing to me in April and May. But that's not always the case for all teachers, right? And I know of many teachers who were so self-conscious because their teaching was on display. And like, teaching is a really vulnerable practice, right? Like, we put ourselves out there, we make mistakes all the time. And usually we have the comfort of making mistakes in front of kids,
right,
who aren't going to report every little thing we say wrong and every little mistake we make. And so I think there's one, that added pressure that a lot of teachers are feeling, that like, wow, I am just on display and I'm in my kids' homes all the time now. And there was the challenge of moving our entire curriculum online and not having, like, I would taught from this little office for 2 months,
right,
with a fraction of the tools. There's the challenge there too, right? Of not having concrete manipulatives. And like, the younger the children get, the harder it is to teach them online. Right. But then there's also been this societal whiplash, right? Of like, it was like, oh, teachers are so amazing. And then all of a sudden, like, the criticality of us or the criticism of us ramped up again. And it's like, we didn't do enough with remote learning. We weren't online enough. Like, we're lazy. We just like working from home. Like, we just don't want to go back to school, you know, all this crap. And it's just like, that is so far from the truth. Like, this teaching from here is actually, it's harder. Like, I was getting these horrible headaches from like my screen and the light and like all this stuff, you know, and it's like, we don't want to do that. We would love to be back in the classroom, sitting in our circles and, you know. And so right now, I think a lot of people are experiencing that same whiplash. It's like, we're getting so much criticism for being like, hey, we have families and we don't want to bring this home to them. You know, I work in an urban setting, right? So it's like, some of the kids in the school take public transit. We were at the beginning of the pandemic, like our cases were skyrocketing too, you know? So it's, people don't think of that. And it's even funny, administrators don't even really think of it. They're the ones who are going to be able to sit in their offices all year long and take Zoom calls all year long and close their door and say, no, you can't come in here. Call me on Zoom or call me on the phone. They're the ones making decisions on our behalf when we're going to have to be in there. And I don't think people like really have grappled with like how unfair that is. And that's another reason why, like, I want to reiterate that I'm not trying to glorify this moment in my life, because it's not glorious. But if we don't talk about how, like, I'm in a position now where I can talk about how unfair that is without fear of repercussions from a school, because I'm not employed by a school anymore.
Right.
You know, and I think we need to keep talking about that, because this truly is, I think, like it is a critical juncture in just our history, mm-hmm. in the history of American education. Like, we've got a chance to change things. And if we don't talk about it, it's not going to change.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think that relationship between administrators mm-hmm. and teachers is something that I don't think many people talk about. And it's something that I think even parents may not realize at their school. Sometimes, even a lot of times, again, I don't want to generalize, but there tends to be a very embattled stance between administrators and teachers. And I think that has a long history, but I think exactly what you said in terms of a lot of times, and again, a lot of administrators I know are phenomenal. They do an amazing job with what they have, but their incentives don't necessarily align with teacher incentives and teacher experience. And so a lot of decisions get made that aren't necessarily what teachers believe is best for learning and for their students. And so, yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit more about that and kind of its relation to, I guess, the broader societal moment. I don't know if you've heard about the college football group in the Pac-10 who are basically finally standing up and saying, hey, college football players have zero say in the college football landscape. And the people who are making money, mostly white coaches, white male coaches and white male administrators, are making billions of dollars off of young, predominantly black male teenage and 20-year-olds. And so they're finally standing up. And it's like, this is the moment, the chance for change to happen in college football. I think that, again, is a similar moment to right now, is like, teachers may have a chance to stand up and actually change things so that both teachers and students get a situation that they've kind of worked for and deserved for so long. And they've been put into this horrible situation where they really don't have much say at all in the education system. And so, I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on, like, how can we do this? How could we maybe align parents and teachers together during this difficult time? Because in the end, parents and teachers want what's best for students. And I think there's so much that goes on in the rest of the system that makes that either difficult or makes, for whatever reason, makes parents feel like they're battling against teachers in a lot of cases. So yeah, so I'd love to kind of talk about this moment and how could we as teachers stand up for this and stand up for what we think is right at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard question to answer, because it's like, there's the grassroots argument and there's the top-down argument. And, you know, I think it's all of those things, right? Like, we need an overhaul of the system, and that's not going to happen unless we vote all these awful, awful people out. You know, I'm mainly talking about the Trump administration, but I think there are people on both sides of the political spectrum that have been corrupted by just the way our political system is funded. And I think there are some well-meaning people out there too that aren't aware of their privilege. And I just think it needs to be attacked from all angles. So I think one thing we need to do first and foremost is like, we all need to get out and vote in a couple months and make sure that, you know, we are at least heading in the right direction with the people that we're choosing to run the education system. You know, I think you're onto something with the idea of like how administrators are incentivized. The education system is using the wrong metrics for success, right? And that is, there's this law. Have you heard of Campbell's Law before?
No, I don't think I have. I'd love to.
So Campbell's Law is like, it states that the metrics used to measure any sort of system, right? Those metrics inevitably distort the process that we're trying to measure in the first place.
Ah, right.
Okay. So for instance, right, like when you put standardized test scores in the center or you make those your success metrics, like people are aware that those are the success metrics. And so they are going to start operating in a way that directly impacts those success metrics.
Right.
And okay. So like it dilutes things, right? So we put like achievement first, academic achievement. And I think that term means a lot of different things to a lot of people, right? So I think no matter where you are, whether it's public or private schools, like everyone's like, how's my kid doing? What's their level? How much have they learned this year?
Right.
And I am someone who believes in assessment. Like I think assessment is helpful, but it's not helpful when you use it as a means to compare or sort or categorize or control human beings, right? It's what assessment should be is this way to better know and understand the people in the system and like almost like a needs assessment, right? Like what are the needs of this community? And so like assessment should be expanded so far beyond literacy skills and math skills, right? Assessment should be, we should be assessing like sense of belonging. We should be assessing the like ancillary systems that inevitably impact the education system, like healthcare and food access and all these things, because we know that kids who come to school hungry and kids who come to school when they are within a family who like is struggling to get access to healthcare and just struggling to like have their basic needs met, we know that schooling is going to be more challenging, right? I don't know, the longer I'm in education, the more I start to think that it's like, it doesn't start with the education system, it starts with the social systems that like inevitably support the education system. And so then I think that like, not to get on too much of a tangent, but that like goes back to thinking about administrators. You know, I do have compassion for administrators because like it's not something I'm choosing to do because it sounds like a nightmare.
Right, right.
You know, and the pressure, I mean, the best administrators out there, right, are the ones that are able to weather the storms from parents and bring them on board. But I think, you know, I think a lot of, in my experience, a lot of the issue I've seen with administrations is that they operate without transparency. You know, like Leadership 101 states that it's okay to make top-down decisions, but when you have to make those decisions, like you have a responsibility to all your stakeholders, to all your constituencies, to explain why you're doing that with transparency, with data, with like, lay it all, put your cards on the table. If you're going to make that decision, put your cards on the table. And so where I start to lose compassion for administrators is when they operate without transparency and they don't put their cards on the table. Because the decision you're making, the decision you're being paid a hell of a lot more than I'm being paid to make is directly impacting my life and my livelihood. And that's especially true right now.
Right.
So it's like you're getting paid double what I get paid to sit in your office and tell me that, oh, it's okay. You'll be fine. You're young. You'll be fine. You're not going to get sick. Like, and if you do, you'll be okay. Like that is not okay. And if you're not willing to, you know, I don't know. Like I had an experience recently where, you know, tuition dollars and was brought into play. And like, I understand that that's a factor at play, right? Like I understand in a private school, it's like, if parents aren't happy, they won't pay their tuition and they'll leave. And then you know, and I think it's okay to talk about that. I don't think it's okay to hold that over educators' heads and say, you know, if we don't go back in person and parents leave, you could lose your job.
Right.
Like, it's like, it just, that feels inappropriate to put, you know, to put on somebody. So that's where I start to lose compassion for administrators.
Right.
But I think a lot of the problems that I'm hearing just from teachers reaching out is just the lack of transparency and the lack of partnership in making this, these decisions.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, I guess that's the biggest challenge, is that, like, up to this point, this is obviously a very unique time in history. Like, this is a global pandemic. We haven't experienced this before, but the kind of system, the experiences that have already been in place for administrators to make decisions, like, that's been happening for years and years and years. And so I'm just curious, in terms of your experience, does this moment feel drastically different than any other moment where administrators have made decisions? And obviously, having our life in danger because of a global pandemic is extremely different. But do you see any threads that we could learn from in terms of your experience and how we might be able to move forward? Because I think that's what I think I would love our audience to hear your expertise about, is like, how the heck do we move forward after, like, during this? Like, how do we either change the incentives, or how do we, just as a group of teachers, as a group of like caring parents, like, what do we do to get out of this mess?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it just feels like it has to be a culture shift, right? And so that's why talking about it is so important to me. And it's, I mean, there's that argument, right? There's that argument that you change policy first and then minds and hearts change.
Right.
And then there's that argument that you change minds and hearts and then policy will change. Mm-hmm. And I've seen both, like, as a gay man, right? Like, I've looked at the data on marriage equality and, like, how passing the laws changed hearts and minds and people suddenly felt comfortable with it, right? So, like, I think there is opportunity there, again, if we change the leadership in our country to change laws and change how schools are funded, that will change the metrics in our schools, right? Because, like, a lot of schools are funded based on, like, either property taxes, or there's some sort of standardized test score that plays a role in how much extra funding you get or whatever. Like, those are two really flawed ways to fund schools, you know? So I think if we were able to vote people in to the government that could change that, you know, I think we would change hearts and minds with the policy change.
Right, right.
Because people would see, like, oh, this is actually benefiting everybody. It's right. there's that whole zero sum myth, right? That, like, someone has to lose in order for me to win. And I think that it's a myth, right? Like,
right.
Affluent suburban school districts are not going to lose because, like, inner city school districts that serve low income students and students of color, like, they're not going to lose because those kids are getting, like, a better opportunity,
right,
you know, for an equitable education. But I think it's, we have to, like, reach a critical mass where just enough people will vote the right people into place.
Right.
And then I think hearts and minds will change. But then I think, like, the culture shift piece, right? And this is where we have to depend on leaders within schools. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to take, I think, some really courageous school leaders or courageous schools, right? Who will change the way they choose leaders.
Right.
Like, they choose, we don't choose leaders based on their ability to lead.
Right.
What ends up happening is we choose people who are, like, really good teachers, or, like, somehow knew the right person and have managed to amass enough, like, social capital and privilege. And then they become a school administrator when they don't have the skill set required to, like, bring people in a challenging time, like right now, and, like, hear from all constituencies and then hold space for all the really big feelings people are having right now. What you have is a lot of really emotionally inept adults,
right,
who are, you know, silencing teachers, and, like, they want to keep everyone as quiet as possible so that it doesn't get out that, like, people are upset. And, right, you know, in the midst of a global pandemic, anxiety, fear, sadness, these are all natural things that people are going to feel.
Right.
And if we don't, as school systems, hold space for them and say, it's okay, like, talk about how you're feeling right now.
Right.
If we don't allow that, then what happens is it becomes like the, you know, it becomes the Mentos in the Diet Coke bottle, right? And, like, we shake it up and shake it up and shake it up, and all of a sudden it explodes. And that's kind of where I feel like I'm at right now. It's, you know, it's like be quiet, shut up. And it's like, no, I'm not going to shut up about this anymore. This is, you know, and so I think there's a culture shift that has to happen, and that culture shift has to change who is in charge of our schools so that we have emotionally competent people who know how to bring people together in the midst of a crisis. And so many schools don't have that right now.
Right. Yeah, I love that idea of a culture shift. And there's one thing I'd love to dig into, because I don't know if our whole audience understands why tying school funding to property taxes or to these random tests, or they're not random, but pretty much random tests.
Pretty random.
Why? Yeah, why? Like, I'd love for you to kind of dig into that a little bit and explain why that isn't a good model, because I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I don't know if the average parent realizes like what that causes within the school system.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think it's important to note that it's all grounded in like white hegemony and white supremacy. Mm. Right. And I know that's like, for some people, that's like, it makes them really uncomfortable to think about that.
Right.
But it's true. And I'll say this as a white man who I grew up in a middle class, upper middle class suburb in Chicago, like my hometown is still probably 90%+ white.
Right.
And so like I went to schools that were always incredibly well funded. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to schools where I had ample opportunity to learn how to read and write and do math. And when I got to high school, we had access to a ton of AP classes and a ton of sports and activities and all those things that develop a child as a human being. Like I had access to all that. And it's because the education system we've built in our country was built for white people who were able to buy property. And the metrics we've put in place to measure how good those systems are and how we direct even more money to those systems or to those schools or those school districts, those success metrics were also built by white people for white people. Mm-hmm. Right. And I know that idea of like standardized tests are built for white people is kind of provocative for some people and makes them uncomfortable. But when you think about it, right, like our entire country was built for white people. So it's inevitable that it was not only built for white people, but it was built to box out people of color and disenfranchise them. So like, and I know that thanks to like so many courageous Black leaders in our country, that a lot of white people are starting to learn about this more. And so what I would want to encourage anyone who's listening to this, if you're feeling uncomfortable by that statement, like just sit with it for a minute. It's not a personal indictment of you. You know, it's not that you necessarily like engineered the system that way. It's just that you're benefiting from it. And by spreading the wealth a little bit more, it's not going to disenfranchise you. It's actually just going to work in favor for all of us. So I don't know if I'm answering your question. Sorry. I feel like I'm getting a little bit on a tangent.
Yeah. But I think you are. And I think that connection is great. And I think that's something that I just would love to get that story out a little bit more, because I don't know if you've listened to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History podcast at all. I talked about this a little bit in my podcast in episode one, where kind of we went over the history of Impact Connections, our company, and kind of my history that led us there to kind of creating another option for learning for students. But there's an episode in season one of Revisionist History where Malcolm Gladwell talks about a student. He calls him Carlos. The title of the episode is Carlos Doesn't Remember. And he basically follows Carlos through his journey as a kid going through education. He grew up in one of the worst parts of Los Angeles, Lenox, and his mom ends up in jail. He ends up going to four different foster homes, taking care of his little sister. He is this brilliant kid that, again, deserves so many opportunities. He thankfully kind of got adopted by a philanthropist who got him into a private school, gave him the opportunities he never would have had being a minority kid growing up in the worst parts of LA where he had to go through gang territory. But the reason why that episode really resonated with me is Malcolm Gladwell talks about how a mile away on the other side of the freeway from where this kid lived was a suburban upper middle class white community where these kids had didn't have any idea that the Carloses of the world were struggling to simply survive. They were doing their education, getting all the opportunity in the world. I grew up in that upper middle class white community on the other side of the freeway. And so I played sports against kids like Carlos. I met kids like Carlos. And so that episode just brought me to tears, like realizing, like you said, there's this inherent inequality in the system that nobody's really fighting for or like trying to change, like really truly trying to change. And so that's what Impact Connections is trying to do, is open up those type of doors to everyone, not just the current, I guess, privilege in the system. And so yeah, no, thank you for sharing that, because I think that's something that I hope our audience is kind of like getting used to hearing, and hey, this system isn't working for everyone and we have to make some changes. And so yeah, so thank you for bringing that up. I'd love to circle back to one of the things you said that I think can help us move forward with better metrics. And you talked about your experience with personalized learning and how a lot of ed tech companies are just sucking money out of the system. And especially during COVID, you see ed tech companies basically cropping up everywhere saying, oh, we can fix this, like do this virtual learning, do this online system, like we can personalize it for you in this way and that way. And I love a term that you like to use in terms of humanizing assessment. So I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about your experience with EdTech and what parents should be concerned with or watching out for as basically they get bombarded with virtual learning solutions that are going to make their kid miraculously become an Einstein.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I've been getting a lot of emails lately that's like from tech companies, just like that are marketing to your average teacher. And like, it's like, oh, we can personalize this and we can personalize that. And, you know, they're very good at what they do, which is selling things.
Right.
And they see an economic demand. And I mean, I guess seeing an economic demand and appealing to it in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing if you're doing it ethically, right? But like, I think anyone who has a platform where they can sell anything, right? They need to make sure that they're operating in an ethical way that's not creating more barriers or causing harm.
Right.
And I think what ed tech companies don't, they either aren't aware of it or they are aware of it and they just don't care, is that by putting out the kinds of programs they're putting out, first and foremost, they're completely like undermining what teachers do. And this is the experience I had in Silicon Valley. That was one of the engineers who was a really nice guy, but like just really ignorant about what teachers do. He had said to me, he was talking to me about AI, and he said the company was exploring AI and how that could change teaching. And he's like, in so many words, was like, think about it, you know, like we could capture Paul France and like turn that into AI, and then like that could be, you know, like teaching the kids. And I was just like, if you can't see me, you probably, because no one can see me right now, I'm like my hands and my eyes are wide open. And I can't remember exactly what I said back to him, but I was like, you know, even if you can do that, even if you could like capture every single thing I know about teaching and every like single piece of my personality and turn it into an artificial into some sort of artificial intelligence software, like even if you could do that, I don't know if I'd want you to.
Right.
You know, and I think that is like, that story is so powerful and so indicative of like the arrogance of education technology companies, that it's like, we can completely take the human out of this and still get all the positive effects of like a good teacher. And that's why I use the word dehumanized and humanized, or the words dehumanized and humanized so much, because that's the problem, right? Is that we have stripped the humanity from teaching and from the education system. And so when you do that, you end up with policies where schools are funded based on property taxes. And you have policies where we use quantitative metrics to like define a human being.
Right.
I mean, you have an education system where if you're a person of color, you get a bunch of less, or you get far less access than a white student gets, right? So with regard to education technology, and this whole push for personalization, like what I want to encourage teachers and parents to do is to like push back and say, hey, I know that that's not learning. Like my child is not a receptacle for knowledge and information. My child is a human, like, and I want my child to be curious. Like I want my child to have a sense of wonder. I want my child to be critical. I want my child to be talking to other people.
Yeah.
And not just, because that is essentially those programs, right? That are like either reading books to them or just giving them problems and using the data to like give them a problem that's like slightly more challenging based on their algorithm. Right. That is really just content consumption. And we know better now, like we've learned from the era of No Child Left Behind and from this standardization era, we've learned that that actually doesn't impact our NAEP scores, right? Like it doesn't, we know that. There's a ton of information out there. And I think 20 years ago, a lot of people were saying that it wasn't gonna work. And, you know, we tried it anyway. It didn't work. Like things are still really broken. We know better now. And so like, and I really, you know, I want to start speaking directly to parents more because I think parents have more power and privilege in school systems than teachers do because administrators are terrified of parents because they know that if the parents are upset, they're going to talk to the school board and the school board is in control of their jobs. And if parents rise up in like collective outrage and say like, hey, my child is not a number. My child is not a receptacle for knowledge. My child is a human being and I want them to, you know, contribute to the world in a positive way. If parents start speaking up, they can actually change the way their schools measure success. Right. And that means having uncomfortable conversations. And that means they might have to lose a little bit of their privilege and their good standing with their administrators. But if enough of them do it, then things will change. And I mean, you just look at the effects of putting kids in front of those, you know, automated programs. They sit there like zombies.
Right.
And
right.
People will say, oh, well, they like it. They really want to do it. It's like, because they're addicted to it.
Right, right.
You know, and addiction is not a good thing. So we have to be the smarter people in this situation. Right? We can't always look at what a kid's doing and say, oh, they like it, so it must be good for them. Like, we don't say that about candy. We don't say that about smoking. Right. We don't say that about a lot of things. And I think we need to have some more critical conversations about technology and its impacts on our kids.
Right. Yeah, and I love that idea of talking directly to parents. And I love your insights about how to do that because as I've helped people with learning pods and trying to get them these other options around learning beyond virtual distance learning, I've heard a common statement, which surprises me because I'm a parent. I have 3 boys. I homeschool them. I absolutely love the experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And it really surprised me when I heard parents say, I do not want to be the one who teaches them, either because they don't think that they can handle teaching, they think their kids won't listen to them. And so there's this very strange feeling that I'm getting from parents is that they want the best education for their kids, but they don't want to be directly involved in it. They want to kind of just give it to somebody else. And I think sometimes that mindset is what causes this disconnect. Like parents think they can just give them, like they give their kids as like a receptacle to the schools. I like that way you put it. Give their kids as a receptacle to the schools will fill them up, and then the parents will get them back these wonderfully educated kids who are on their pathway to success. I'm curious, how can we switch that mindset? How do we communicate or tell a story to parents where it's like, once you take a bigger role in your kid's education and you reach out to your administrators and say, like, my kid isn't a number, the way you put it, like, my kid's not a number. I want you to develop the whole child. How do we help parents do that or realize that that's important for their kids? Because I'm not sure how to do that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if I had an answer for that, I would be a millionaire. Yeah. But I think, again, it goes back to like a culture shift. And I think it is about partnering with parents. You know, it's like we have to build good relationships with parents so that we can give them hard feedback sometimes too and be like, hey, so part of the reason that your child's struggling with reading is because they never read. Right. And like, I can't control what happens after 3 o'clock at your home, but you can.
Right.
And so you're going to have to make them read, or you're going to have to like, and I'm happy to give you tips on that and like be an accountability partner, but like, we've got to work together. And I think part of what you're shining a light onto right now is the fact, it's just how pervasive the capitalist mentality is in all aspects of our life, right? Parents see schools as a service that they are paying for, and you know that we're responsible to, like someone on Twitter the other day, they were like, well, parents are your customers and you wouldn't have a job if it weren't for the parents as customers. And I was like, whoa. Yeah. I'm sorry. If I privately tutor kids, okay, those parents are like kind of my clients. I get that. But like when I'm working for a school, like those parents aren't my clients. They're not my customers. What I expect from my parents is that they are partners in the process of growing their child. And I understand to a certain point, right? Like I really value what teachers do and the really complex and nuanced knowledge base we have to be able to educate kids. And I get that not everybody has that. Like parents haven't been trained in that. Parents don't understand learning science. So I can identify with that, with them wanting help and wanting support from a knowledgeable professional. Like that's what I am and that's what I'm here to do.
Right.
But it shouldn't be one way, right? It should be like, we're here together, we're partnering. You know, I always say to parents, like, I can get away with things that you can't because the relationship's different. But likewise, you can get away with things that I can't get away with.
Right.
And so if we leverage our strengths here, we can actually both help your child in the ways that we're equipped to. Right. And I think that's the part of the problem, right? Is like everybody, parents, teachers, administrators, they truly need to come into conversations about their children as partnerships, knowing that we're all going to contribute something. We're all going to have a say. This isn't like, I'm not your personal assistant. You can't tell me like, oh, I need you to provide me a workbook. You know, it's like, that's not what I do. I don't provide workbooks. Like I teach. And so it's about partnership. It's about mutual respect. It's about valuing each other's humanity in that partnership too. And I think that would change a lot. But again, it goes back to just how our society is structured. We are structured in this very transactional capitalist way, and it's impacting everything that we know.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely a challenge. I think there's many times at my old schools where I would go around the lunchroom and I'd ask, just because I was curious, hey, who do you think our end user is? And it's amazing how that one question can create a huge discussion argument at a lunch table where I don't know if it's 50-50 or I don't know what the percentages were, but some teachers thought that parents were our end user, period. Some people thought that students were our end user. And then there's a third group that thought colleges were our end user. And so that whole discussion, again, is fascinating. And I think it's one thing, again, any startup, any entrepreneur will tell you, like, the first thing you got to do is define your end user. And the fact that schools never even have that discussion, let alone agree upon it, is very interesting. So yeah, so thanks for giving that insight. I'm curious. I want to respect your time, but I would love to hear, so what's next for you? What are you kind of imagining as your next way to impact education, to impact kids? What are your goals as you kind of go on the next leg of your journey?
Well, my next goal is to make sure that I can eat for the next 10 months.
That is important.
Yeah, you know, like I honestly, there's just a lot of uncertainty for me right now. There really is. I think that I've built so much of my life and my persona around being a classroom teacher, being inside the classroom. So this is really shaking up my perception of myself, or my what I know to be true about myself and my vision for my future. I want to keep writing, that's for sure, because I think stories are so powerful, and that's just the way I write, right? Is through stories and storytelling. And, you know, I try to do my best to weave in research, you know, so that it's not just I'm making these claims that aren't backed up by anything. But I find that the storytelling is the most powerful thing. It's the thing that makes me a good teacher. but it also just makes me a good teacher of teachers. So I want to keep doing that because I think we just need more humanity in our school system. We need to, like, you know, we need to restore that to our school systems. I want to find ways to keep impacting kids. I'm going to be, you know, just to get by over the next year, I'm going to be doing some tutoring and exploring some of the instructional pod, you know, ideas. We'll see. I mean, we have to acknowledge though that, like, instructional pods are inequitable. Like, it's going to, parents who can afford to pay for it are going to get that. And so that's not a solution, right? That's, to me, if I end up doing that, it would be no more than a personal solution for my family so that we can pay our mortgage and eat over the next year, you know, like it's, so that's has the potential to be in my future this year. And then I'd really like to start working with schools. You know, I think part of the challenge with education technology is they're businesses, right? And they're trying to get as much money as they can to stay afloat. And, like, in order for a business to stay afloat, they have to have enough revenue coming in. And what I want to do in working with schools is show them that, like, actually by cutting out all that noise and, like, investing instead in the people in your school, you actually will probably save yourself time and energy and money in the long run. Like, stop looking for the quick fix. Stop looking for the tool that's going to, quote unquote, personalize learning and raise your test scores. And, like, actually focus on the humanity in your school, because if you focus on that, you're going to have people that are invested in your community. You're going to have people that, like, care about the other people in your community. You're going to have people that are intrinsically motivated to make your community a more inclusive and better place to learn. And that's the work I want to be doing. Those are the conversations I want to be having. So I am going to be trying to, you know, build out some sort of consulting work or just working with schools, and we'll see where it goes. I mean, the greatest moments from my summer were leading my book club, like for my book, and connecting with other teachers. Like, those were the happiest moments of my summer. And so if I can continue to do that, that's what I want to do.
Nice. That's awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you so, so much for your time.
Of course, thank you.
Don't want to go over.
Thank you for listening to the Learning Pod Network. If you'd like more information about our offerings and services, please go to www.impactconnections.org. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at ImpactConnectED. We will also be releasing our weekly newsletter called Teaching Tuesday, every Tuesday, where you'll get a summary of all of our latest information and resources that we have found as we explore the best practices of learning pods and education during COVID-19. So thank you, and we hope you'll join us next week. Take care, be well, and teach together.